Chapter 15.
Why, Bert, you're squiffed, Mary cried reproachfully. The four were at the table in the private room at Barnum's. The wedding supper, simple enough, but seemingly too expensive to Saxon, had been eaten. Bert, in his hand a glass of California red wine, which the management supplied for 50 cents a bottle, was on his feet endeavoring a speech. His face was flushed, his black eyes were feverishly bright. "You've been drinking before you met me," Mary continued. "I can see it sticking out all over you." "Consult an oculist, my dear," he replied. "Bertram is himself tonight. And he is here, arise into his feet, to give the glad hand to his old pal. Bill, old man, here's to you. It's how they do and goodbye, I guess. You're a married man now, Bill, and you got to keep regular hours. No more running around with the boys. You got to take care of yourself and get your life insured and take out an accident policy and join a building and loan society and a bury an association. Now you shut up, Bert, Mary broke in. You don't talk about buryings at weddings. You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Whoa, Mary. Back up. I said what I said because I meant it. I ain't thinking what Mary thinks. What I was thinking, let me tell you what I was thinking. I said bury an association, didn't I? Well, it was not with the idea of casting gloom over this merry gathering. Far be it. He was so evidently seeking a way out of his predicament that Mary tossed her head triumphantly. This acted as a spur to his reeling wits. Let me tell you why, he went on. Because, Bill, you got such an all-fired pretty wife, that's why. All the fellows is crazy over her, and when they get to running after her, what'll you be doing? You'll be getting busy. And then won't you need a buryin' association to bury em? I just guess yes. That was the compliment to your good taste in skirts I was trying to come across with when Mary butted in. His glittering eyes rested for a moment in battering triumph on Mary. Who says I'm squiffed? Me. Not on your life. I'm seeing all things in a clear white light. And I see Bill there, my old friend Bill. And I don't see two Bills. I see only one. Bill was never two-faced in his life. Bill, old man, when I look at you there in the married harness, I'm sorry, he ceased abruptly and turned on Mary. Now don't go up in the air, old girl. I'm onto my job. My grandfather was a state senator, and he could spiel graceful and pleasing till the cows come home. So can I, Bill, when I look at you, I'm sorry. I repeat, I'm sorry. He glared challengingly at Mary. For myself, when I look at you and know all the happiness you got to hammerlock on. Take it from me, you're a wise guy, bless the women. You've started well. Keep it up. Marry em all, bless em. Bill, here's to you. You're a Mohegan with a scalp lock. And you got a squaw that is some squaw, take it from me. Minnehaha, here's to you, to the two of you, and to the papooses, too, gosh dang them. He drained the glass suddenly and collapsed in his chair, blinking his eyes across at the wedded couple, while tears trickled unheeded down his cheeks. Mary's hand went out soothingly to his, completing his breakdown. By God, I got a right to cry, he sobbed. I'm losing my best friend, ain't I? It'll never be the same again, never. When I think of the fun, and scrapes, and good times Bill and me has had together, I could darn near hate you, Saxon, sitting there with your hand in his. Cheer up, Bert, she laughed gently. Look at whose hand you are holding. Oh, it's only one of his crying jags, Mary said, with a harshness that her free hand belied as it caressed his hair with soothing strokes. Buck up, Bert. Everything's all right. And now it's up to Bill to say something after your dandy spiel. Bert recovered himself quickly with another glass of wine. Kick in, Bill, he cried. It's your turn now. I'm no hot air artist, Billy grumbled,
What'll I say, Saxon? They ain't no use telling them how happy we are. They know that. Tell them we're always going to be happy, she said. And thank them for all their good wishes, and we both wish them the same. And we're always going to be together, like old times, the four of us. And tell them they're invited down to 507 Pine Street next Sunday for Sunday dinner, and, Mary, if you want to come Saturday night you can sleep in the spare bedroom. You've told me yourself better than I could. Billy clapped his hands. You did yourself proud, and I guess they ain't much to add to it, but just the same I'm going to pass them a hot one. He stood up, his hand on his glass. His clear blue eyes under the dark brows, and framed by the dark lashes, seemed a deeper blue, and accentuated the blondness of hair and skin. The smooth cheeks were rosy, not with wine, for it was only his second glass, but with health and joy. Saxon, looking up at him, thrilled with pride in him, he was so well-dressed, so strong, so handsome, so clean-looking, her man-boy. And she was aware of pride in herself, in her woman's desirableness, that had won for her so wonderful a lover. Well, Bert and Mary, here you are at Saxon's, and my wedding supper. We're just going to take all your good wishes to heart, we wish you the same back, and when we say it we mean more than you think we mean. Saxon and I believe in tit for tat. So we're wishing for the day, when the table is turned clear around and we're sitting as guests at your wedding supper. And then, when you come to Sunday dinner, you can both stop Saturday night in the spare bedroom. I guess I was wise up when I furnished it, eh? I never thought it of you, Billy. Mary exclaimed. You're every hit as raw as Bert. But just the same. There was a rush of moisture to her eyes. Her voice faltered and broke. She smiled through her tears at them, then turned to look at Bert, who put his arm around her and gathered her onto his knees. When they left the restaurant, the four walked to 8th and Broadway, where they stopped beside the electric car. Bert and Billy were awkward and silent, oppressed by a strange aloofness. But Mary embraced Saxon with fond anxiousness. It's all right, dear, Mary whispered. Don't be scared. It's all right. Think of all the other women in the world. The conductor clanged the gong, and the two couples separated in a sudden hubbub of farewell. Oh, you Mohegan! Bert called after, as the car got underway. Oh, you Minnehaha! Remember what I said, was Mary's parting to Saxon. The car stopped at 7th and Pine, the terminus of the line. It was only a little over 2 blocks to the cottage. On the front steps Billy took the key from his pocket. Funny, isn't it? He said, as the key turned in the lock. You and me? Just you and me? While he lighted the lamp in the parlor, Saxon was taking off her hat. He went into the bedroom and lighted the lamp there, then turned back and stood in the doorway. Saxon, still unaccountably fumbling with her hatpins, stole a glance at him. He held out his arms. Now, he said. She came to him, and in his arms he could feel her trembling.
Book 2 Chapter 1
The first evening after the marriage night, Saxon met Billy at the door, as he came up the front steps. After their embrace, and as they crossed the parlor hand in hand toward the kitchen, he filled his lungs through his nostrils with audible satisfaction. Mike, but this house smells good, Saxon. It ain't the coffee, I can smell that, too. It's the whole house. It smells, well, it just smells good to me, that's all. He washed and dried himself at the sink while she heated the frying pan on the front hole of the stove with the lid off. As he wiped his hands, he watched her keenly and cried out with approbation as she dropped the steak in the frying pan. Where'd you learn to cook steak on a dry, hot pan? It's the only way, but darn few women seem to know about it. as she took the cover off a second frying pan and stirred the savory contents with a kitchen knife. He came behind her, passed his arms under her armpits with down-drooping hands upon her breasts, and bent his head over her shoulder, till cheek touched cheek. Fried potatoes with onions, like mother used to make me for them. Don't they smell good, though? The pressure of his hands relaxed, and his cheek slid caressingly past hers as he started to release her. Then his hands closed down again. She felt his lips on her hair, and heard his advertised inhalation of delight. Don't you smell good, yourself, though? I never understood what they meant when they said a girl was sweet. I know, now. And you're the sweetest I ever knew. His joy was boundless. When he returned from combing his hair in the bedroom and sat down at the small table opposite her, he paused with knife and fork in hand. Say, being married is a whole lot more than it's cracked up to be by most married folks. Honest to God, Saxon, we can show 'em a few. We can give 'em cards and spades and little casino and win out on big casino and the aces. I've got but one kickoman. The instant apprehension in her eyes provoked a chuckle from him. And that is that we didn't get married quick enough. Just think. I've lost a whole week of this. Her eyes shone with gratitude and happiness, and in her heart she solemnly pledged herself that never in all their married life would it be otherwise. Supper finished, she cleared the table and began washing the dishes at the sink. When he evinced the intention of wiping them, she caught him by the lapels of the coat and backed him into a chair. You'll sit right there, if you know what's good for you. Now be good, and mind what I say. Also, you will smoke a cigarette. No, you're not going to watch me. There's the morning paper beside you. And if you don't hurry to read it, I'll be through these dishes before you've started. As he smoked and read, she continually glanced across at him from her work. One thing more, she thought, slippers, and then the picture of comfort and content would be complete. Several minutes later, Billy put the paper aside with a sigh. It's no use, he complained. I can't read. What's the matter? She teased. Eyes weak? Nope. They're sore. And there's only one thing to do, any good, and that's looking at you. All right, then, baby Billy, I'll be through in a jiffy. When she had washed the dish towel and scalded out the sink, she took off her kitchen apron, came to him, and kissed first one eye and then the other. How are they now? Cured. They feel some better already. She repeated the treatment. And now? Still better. And now? Almost well. After he had adjudged them well, he ouched and informed her that there was still some hurt in the right eye. In the course of treating it, she cried out as in pain. Billy was all alarm. What is it? What hurt you? My eyes. They're hurting like 60. And Billy became physician for a while, and she the patient. When the cure was accomplished, she led him into the parlor, where, by the open window, they succeeded in occupying the same Morris chair. It was the most expensive comfort in the house. It had cost $7.50, and, though it was grander than anything she had dreamed of possessing, the extravagance of it had worried her in a half-guilty way all day. The salt chill of the air that is the blessing of all the Bay Cities, after the sun goes down, crept in about them. They heard the switch engines puffing in the railroad yards, and the rumbling thunder of the 7th Street local slowing down in its run from the Mole to stop at West Oakland Station. From the street came the noise of children playing in the summer night, and from the steps of the house next door the low voices of gossiping housewives. Can you beat it? Billy murmured. When I think of that $6 furnished room of mine, it makes me sick to think what I was missing all the time. But there's one satisfaction. If I changed it sooner, I wouldn't have had you. You see, I didn't know you existed only until a couple of weeks ago. His hand crept along her bare forearm, and up and partly under the elbow sleeve. Your skin's so cool, he said. It ain't cold, it's cool. It feels good to the hand. Pretty soon you'll be calling me your cold storage baby, she laughed. And your voice is cool, he went on. It gives me the feeling just as your hand does when you rest it on my forehead. It's funny. I can't explain it. But your voice just goes all through me, cool and fine. It's like a wind of coolness, just right. It's like the first of the sea breeze setting in the afternoon, after a scorching hot morning. And sometimes, when you talk low, it sounds round and sweet like the cello in the McDonough Theater Orchestra. And it never goes high up, or sharp, or squeaky, or scratchy, like some women's voices, when they're mad, or fresh, or excited, till they remind me of a bum phonograph record. Why, your voice, it just goes through me till I'm all trembling, like with the everlasting cool of it. It's hit straight delicious. I guess angels in heaven, if they's any, must have voices like that. After a few minutes, in which, so inexpressible was her happiness, that she could only pass her hand through his hair and cling to him, he broke out again. I'll tell you what you remind me of. Did you ever see a thoroughbred mare, all shining in the sun, with hair like satin and skin so thin and tender that the least touch of the whip leaves a mark, all fine nerves and delicate and sensitive, that'll kill the toughest bronco when it comes to endurance and that can strain a tendon in a flash or catch death of cold without a blanket for a night? I want to tell you they ain't many beautifuler sights in this world. And they're that fine strung and sensitive and delicate. You got to handle 'em right side up, glass, with care. Well, that's what you remind me of. And I'm going to make it my job to see you get handled and gentled in the same way. You're as different from other women as that kind of a mare is from scrub workhorse mares. You're a thoroughbred. You're clean-cut and spirited, and your lines. Say, Inouye, you've got some figure. Well, you have. Talk about Annette Kellerman. You can give her cards and spades. She's Australian, and you're American, only your figure ain't. You're different. You're nifty, I don't know how to explain it. Other women ain't built like you. You belong in some other country. You're Frenchy, that's what. You're built like a French woman, and more than that, the way you walk, move, stand up or sit down, or don't do anything. And he, who had never been out of California, or, for that matter, had never slept a night away from his birth town of Oakland, was right in his judgment. She was a flower of Anglo-Saxon stock, a rarity in the exceptional smallness and fineness of hand and foot and bone and grace of flesh and carriage, some throwback across the face of time to the foreign Norman French that had intermingled with the sturdy Saxon breed. And in the way you carry your clothes, they belong to you. They seem just as much part of you as the cool of your voice and skin. They're always all right and couldn't be better. And you know, a fellow kind of likes to be seen tagging around with a woman like you that wears her clothes like a dream and hear the other fellows say, "Who's Bill's new skirt? She's a peach, ain't she? Wouldn't I like to win her, though?" And all that sort of talk. And Saxon, her cheek pressed to his, knew that she was paid in full for all her midnight sewings and the torturing hours of drowsy stitching when her head nodded with the weariness of the day's toil, while she recreated for herself felched ideas from the dainty garments that had steamed under her passing iron. "Say, Saxon, I got a new name for you. You're my tonic kid. That's what you are, the tonic kid. And you'll never get tired of me?" she queried. "Tired? Why, we was made for each other. Isn't it wonderful, our meeting, Billy? We might never have met. It was just by accident that we did." "We was born lucky," he proclaimed. "That's a cinch." "Maybe it was more than luck," she ventured. "Sure. It just had to be. It was fate. Nothing could have kept us apart." They sat on in a silence that was quick with unuttered love, till she felt him slowly draw her more closely and his lips come near to her ear as they whispered, "What do you say we go to bed?" Many evenings they spent like this, varied with an occasional dance, with trips to the Orpheum and to Bell's Theatre, or to the moving picture shows, or to the Friday night band concerts in City Hall Park. Often, on Sunday, she prepared a lunch, and he drove her out into the hills behind Prince and King, whom Billy's employer was still glad to have him exercise. Each morning Saxon was called by the alarm clock. The first morning he had insisted upon getting up with her and building the fire in the kitchen stove. She gave in the first morning, but after that she laid the fire in the evening, so that all that was required was the touching of a match to it. And in bed she compelled him to remain for a last little doze ere she called him for breakfast. For the first several weeks she prepared his lunch for him. Then, for a week, he came down to dinner. After that he was compelled to take his lunch with him. It depended on how far distant the deeming was done. "You're not starting right with a man," Mary cautioned. "Do you wait on him hand and foot? You'll spoil him if you don't watch out. It's him that ought to be waiting on you." "He's the breadwinner," Saxon replied. "He works harder than I, and I've got more time, and I know what to do with time to burn. Besides, I want to wait on him, because I love to, and because, well, anyway, I want to,